Welcome to part two of our conversation with Dr. Laurel Parnell, where we continue to explore the transpersonal and transformational nature of EMDR therapy, altered healing states, and how the healing power of EMDR replicates the healing techniques of our ancient ancestors. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution. Yeah, I wanted to share experience when you said that after death communication with a loved one. Well, I've talked about this, but I lost my older brother. We were very close to suicide in my house. You know, it was really, it set me on a downward spiral for 4 years. I was taking psychedelic mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms one time, and I was just looking in the mirror, which is a powerful thing to do if you haven't done. Don't do this at home, kids. In that experience, my brother showed up and he just said, John, I'm okay. I'm better than I've ever been. You don't have to worry about me. And I was just, oh, really? Thank God. And what happened is it really did heal. It wasn't just the experience. You know, you can have these altered states where, you know, really good things happen. But I can think about him now, and I can think about his suicide, and I can think about I'm probably more connected to him than almost any other family member in that way, because somehow it shifted, got healed. Really a grace, and it's extraordinary. And I just wanted to share that because that stuff does happen.
I'm so glad you shared it, and I'm sorry for your loss, because there's that connection with them from the other side, but there's still the reality of the loss itself. One of the EMDR experiences that I've written about was a woman in my class. Again, I was doing a demonstration with her, and she wanted to be my demonstration subject. She jumped in front of me. This was at Omega, those of you who know Omega Institute. And she was filled with guilt and trauma. So she herself was probably in her 40s. When she was in college, her high school boyfriend had hung himself, and she felt, she didn't witness it, she heard about it, but she felt guilty. She felt bad about how they broke up. She felt responsible. She was filled with terrible guilt and trauma around this. She said she couldn't see a rope because that would activate the imagery that she created in her mind. And so what we did was, we went in, and our EMDR target, so to speak, was how she imagined he died. So very often the person doesn't see it, but they've created in their mind a mental picture of that. So she created in her mind the mental picture of how he had killed himself, hanging himself. And so in this case, I was tapping on her knees. And so she's crying and sobbing and sobbing. And she said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And then it felt like he suddenly shows up in the room, like the hair is standing up on my arms, and she hears him talking to her. And he starts saying, it wasn't your fault. You know, you didn't do anything wrong. I'm okay. All of these things. And so he's just communicating. And she's hearing him, and she's reporting some of what he just told her. And there was one part, I can't remember all of what happened, but we returned to the image of the hanging because there was still some of that left. I said to her, what's still there? It's still, the rope was really disturbing. So we went with that. Again, I'm tapping her knees. I'm not doing anything in terms of directing her except for bringing her back and looking at what's still there. And so she says, now his name was Michael. Now it's like he's like a scarecrow, like a stuffed dummy. The body is not even his body, it's just a stuffed dummy. And his spiritual self, like his angelic spiritual self, now goes up to where the dummy is hanging and takes him off the noose, holds him, and he takes the rope And he goes like this. He flings it into the sky and it becomes a stairway. And he then climbs the stairway into the sky with this dummy and they dissolve into light and they become stars. And she's sobbing and I'm sure I'm crying too. And then she says, you know, it was like it was gone. And she had a sense of him there as a spiritual helping presence for her. The trauma was gone. There was a sense of complete forgiveness, but there really wasn't anything to forgive. Nothing, none of it was connected to her. And the image of the rope was all gone. This was in a group of people. Everybody is just crying and filled with this energy and this awesomeness, right? And I didn't do anything but tap on her knees and say, go with that and look for where there might have been anything left. She later wrote to me and she said, it might have been a year later, a month later, giving me permission to present this. And she said that I now feel that he's a presence with me, a benevolent presence, looking at like a guardian angel kind of a thing. And the trauma of it is completely gone. It was such a beautiful experience of this. And what I want to say is I've had so many, many, many of these over the years in my trainings, myself personally, and a psychologist named Alan Botkin, who worked for the Chicago VA, working with post-traumatic stress disorder, resistant veterans. I mean, they weren't healing. They had such trauma, mostly because they killed people. He began to spontaneously have these same kinds of experiences with his VA guys. They were spontaneously happening. And then he wrote about it and he did research on it. Thousands of them he did. And then he developed a protocol for inducing after-death communications. And he has a book called Induced After-Death Communication. My feeling, so he and I have connected over the years. He was not a transpersonally oriented psychologist at all. All of this just was happening spontaneously in his work with these veterans. I believe he made a short film about this. He certainly wrote this book. The difference between how he works and how I work is my goal isn't to induce any kind of experience. My goal is to help free the person from whatever is keeping them from living fully. And if they need to communicate something, then I'll facilitate that. But I'm not going to purposely look to induce a particular state of consciousness. So whereas he is more focused on that, but it's, again, he's done thousands of them. I don't know that he's still doing this. He may still be doing this. He's no longer working for the VA, but this was such validation and I'm not the only one. So this is some of what these kinds of experiences that people are having that are really important for therapists to not shut down or to not interpret or pathologize or any of that, to just create the space for this to unfold and complete itself.
Whoa.
You didn't know this, Roger.
Well, you have written about these kinds of things quite a bit, and I don't doubt them. I mean, I've certainly had, if you had some remarkable experiences myself, not those kind of communications. Those don't seem to come up for me, but I'm just, again, awed by the psyche or our human nature. I mean, we are so much more than we usually imagine. In fact, so much more than we probably can imagine. And again, coming back to your theme of the importance of open-mindedness, one could call it tolerance of ambiguity using psychological language, but it feels deeper than that. It feels like this is openness to the mystery.
That's it.
Yeah.
Tolerance, that's like not the right word at all. It's really openness. I love that openness to the mystery. It's that don't know mind.
Yes. Don't know. Sunsanim was the person you're thinking of.
That's
right. The
don't
Korean Zen
mind.
Master. Only keep don't know mind. Yeah. And so important for this. Again, one of the things that has blown me away in recent years is just appreciating how powerful. Well, first off, yes, how powerful limiting beliefs are about ourselves and other people, and how universal they are in all of us. and the importance and power of recognizing those.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Roger, you know, you're a psychotherapist, a psychiatrist, a meditator of years and years of experience in teaching meditation. What was it like, if you don't have to do this, you don't want to, but I would just be curious, what was the issue that initially got you there? And what was your experience? And you kept going back for 20 years. So, and you said it opened up you to deeper spiritual experiences also. So can you say kind of phenomenologically what it felt like for you to go through this process?
Yeah. Well, in my case, it wasn't a specific issue that drew me to working with Laurel and to trying EMDR. It was, if this data is true, this is a revolution in trauma work. And so I was really curious. And of course, all of us have traumas. In my case, fortunately, rather small T traumas. I can remember, for example, my personality has been conflict avoidant, hypersensitive to criticism, as we all have. And when I started exploring in therapy, in my therapies, or in my, I can't remember where I first explored, well, what was that about? But I'd find if someone criticized me, the thought that would come up is, I'm bad, no one likes me. And then if I kept with that, stayed with that, I go right back to a childhood experience, coming to school and finding a group of kids waiting to beat me up. And I had a session on that with Laurel. And I would say about immediately 50% of the interpersonal hypersensitivity dissolved. Incomplete. I still don't like it. People criticize me, but the reactivity is so much less. And it was so clear going into that experience, letting it process through, which and experiences old traumatic memories just process through faster with EMDR. Laurel's been saying that repeatedly, and that's my own experience. But what is so striking, and I think one of the things Laurel has introduced into in recognition in the EMDR world, is that there is the potential for example, one can start with a traumatic experience, but as Laurel said, there's no way of knowing where it's ended. I mean, so many times I've gone into a experience, or it's just the end of a relationship, for example, and starting with anger or sadness, and ending up in some exquisitely beautiful transpersonal space once some of the charge around the relationship loss has been worked through. As Laurel's been saying, that doesn't have to be the end point, which it is for most therapy and most therapists. Oh, great. You don't have so much charge around that. Wonderful. Okay, next problem. No, it can be an opening into a transpersonal experience. And I have to say, as I said, I never know where these things are going to go. It's like, often at the end of a session with Laurel, I sure wasn't expecting that. So, of course, neither of us were, but that's the beauty. This openness to the mystery and openness to possibilities, and particularly working with a therapist such as Laurel, who has a very deep spiritual practice, so I can share my experiences and she can relate and resonate with them and point further or suggest further possibilities or further ways of different ways of looking at it and opening to it. So it's been therapeutically healing to do this work, but it's also been spiritually opening, both.
Thank you, Roger. That's really, really helpful. Appreciate that.
You know, something else I wanted to say, and I don't know how this is going to land, but there's something also very powerful about that connection with the client-therapist connection, in that as the client is moving these constructs and all of this out, the therapist is also experiencing this moving out. So the places where so many of us have similar kind of receptor sites, if you want, or complexes that are still in our body minds, or places of holding, as the client is clearing them out, there's a reciprocal resonant healing process that is happening. So the client gets clear. The therapist is also clearing whatever is resonant in themselves. It is extraordinary. So I feel like a big part of my spiritual practice over, you want to say, for years has been this kind of healing, cleaning process that you have as you're journeying with your clients, because it's profoundly touching the therapist too. So when the client experiences the vastness of consciousness and the non, just that everything is exactly as it is in that big space, I'm experiencing that at the same time. It's like I'm having, it's like satsang, really remembering, but you're having this feeling that's all, it's a body-based full experience of that. And so over and over and over again, there's experience of, oh, here are these places in the person I'm working with. We work through them and it moves it out. And we're sitting there with this energy, this love, this whatever it is that we're both connected to. So there's a feeling of merging in this, the wonder of it all, if you want, the mystery. And there's nobody who's doing that. So this is where it facilitates, I think, the dissolution of the self-constructs in the therapist as well as the client. I think there's this connection that's happening, this resonant connection in the healing process.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And again, I'm reminded of Jung, who said, you know, if a therapist, and some humanistic therapists would agree, if the therapist isn't transformed as well, then something's not working. And you pointed to the resonance between therapist and client. And that raises the question. Now, you've done a lot of spiritual work, so you have this capacity for opening to these states and experiences. And I know for myself, that's been extremely beneficial, because I know that I can share any of these experiences and you'll get them and resonate and be able to give feedback. But that's not true of a lot of therapists. So again, the question, to what extent does the, and I guess part of a more general question as part of therapy in particular, to what extent do our own limitations as human beings, as therapists, limit the capacity of our possibilities or potentials of our clients to open and heal, and particularly in this case, to open to profound spiritual experiences?
It's a good question, Roger, and I really don't know. I think the therapist should have a basic meditation practice of sitting, of having that silent mind, being able to notice, you know, basic Vipassana is so helpful to really disidentify with the thoughts and feelings and body sensations and not imprison, not project that onto the client, that who the client is, are their thoughts and the things that happen to them. So the extent to which the therapist can be present, I think presence is so important. You know, all this, all the distractions that people have, presence and a basic practice of watching thoughts, of coming back to the moment. I think that is kind of a baseline. And then the ability to be curious and not interpret and allow what's unfolding to unfold without needing to define it or constrain it or to take the power, that kind of openness. And I think that the therapist over time doing this work with that orientation can begin to open to spirituality. I think it just happens on its own.
Interesting.
I think. I don't know. I think this is, you know, we're all a work in progress. I think our whole life is about learning and unfolding and experiencing. And it's not like you're done, you know, because something else is going to show up in your life that's going to throw you off. And you're going to go, okay, this is something else that I need to learn how to face or to be with or whatever it is. So, but I think that when we have basic tools for doing that, we can refer back to that. And I think that that really helps.
Laurel, is this a technique you can do alone at home?
EMDR?
Yeah, this however you want to do it.
Yeah, so I think that there are some things we can do on our own that we can move them through. For example, a recent trauma like you had a car accident, you're shaken up, you can do what I call tapping through the trauma. You can play the movie of what happened from beginning to end, the end meaning I'm okay, I survived. And you can use bilateral stimulation through that and really move it out of your nervous system. Things like that that have a scary thing and a positive resolution, you can use bilateral stimulation to move it out for sure. You can also do what we call resource tapping or resource installation. This is where we call up resources that are going to be supportive of us. This is where partly how I've evolved EMDR is doing what we call resource installation or resource tapping. So Francine's way of doing EMDR was basically throw the person in the deep end and then they're going to survive and they'll get through it, which has not been good for a lot of people. It's given EMDR a very bad name because some people get through the trauma, but they've been traumatized by how they got through the trauma because it was so overwhelming for them. What I strongly believe in is strengthening people before we go in the big and do the big stuff. So what we do is what I call the four foundational resources. It's a peaceful place, a place they can imagine that's peaceful and calm, that settles their nervous system. Nurturing figures. These are figures, real or imaginary, that have a nurturing quality. Protector figures. These are figures, real or imaginary, that are protective. It could be, you know, a grizzly bear. It could be an action figure. It could be your protective adult self. And then wise figure, a figure that you can call on for wisdom. So we'll go through and we do what we call tapping in these figures. So they imagine a figure that is nurturing and kind and calm. It could be, let's say, an angel. They can imagine an angel and they imagine her and they feel her benevolence and her kindness and her compassion. And then they add short amount of bilateral stimulation. So with these resources, what's different between the resourcing and standard EMDR is with the resources, we focus it on what we're trying to cultivate and develop. So if we're wanting to cultivate these nurturing figures, we imagine the figure, we light up the neural network where that figure is activating. We get a good, strong sense of it. And then we use a short amount of bilateral stimulation. I wrote a book called Tapping In for Sounds True that's all about this. So you get a good, strong sense of the nurturing quality and the feeling of the figure. And you tap maybe 6 to 12 times or longer, as long as it's positive. And then you've got that figure. Then we move on to the next one and the next one. And so we end up with a team of figures, as well as the peaceful place, that are supportive of the work. And then we can even invoke them as a team. Can you imagine them all as a team? Oh yeah, I've got the Dalai Lama. I've got my best friend. I've got my dog that I had as a child. I've got the mother grizzly bear. I've got Nelson Mandela. I've got this amazing team of support that I've evoked in my imagination. And then I've got a feeling for them. So what this does is it creates a safety net for the process. If the person, when they're doing the big stuff, gets stuck, we can call in one of the resources for help. They're doing what we call looping. Their father is abusing them and they can't get out of the room and this terrible thing is happening. I'll stop and say, okay, what does your child need? I need protection. Who can do it? Oh, the grizzly bear. She can come in and scare him away. Okay, imagine that. Add bilateral stimulation. So we create these resources to create more support for the work, to create a safety net, and then we can use them if we need to, if the person is getting stuck in a bad place and they need to call in for help. So this technology of activating strong supportive resources, I've expanded into a whole other realm of way of working. It works really well cross-culturally. I teach all over the world, and there are certain cultures that are really affect averse. Certain Asian cultures, Chinese, Singaporeans, I've been teaching in Singapore for years. It's just not in the culture to feel comfortable with strong affect. And so, but the resourcing, they love it. They can work really well with the resourcing. So there's all kinds of ways of working with imagery that is helpful and supportive and healing, adding bilateral stimulation to that, that links it into the fuller neural circuitry. So we think of, if a person is living with, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, but we can evoke resources that have power. We light them up. We add bilateral stimulation. It links it into the fuller neurocircuitry. And the person doesn't feel so powerless. They have access to these inner resources that they didn't have before.
Yeah, Laurel, I want to advertise for your YouTube clip because you did exactly what you're talking about in this particular thing. You know, she evoked the place where she felt safe, the people that could protect her, and all of these things. And you had a little clicker in your hand or something, it looked like.
Yeah. So that's equipment. Roger knows about this. It was a company called Neurotech Corporation. So they're little pulsers. It comes with pulsers and headphones, and the pulsers vibrate. The person can put them under their legs. They can hold them. They can put them in their pockets. The therapist or the client can control it. And it goes alternately, right, left, right, left, right, left, with a little buzzy feeling. Mm-hmm. And it can go faster, slower. You can set it to the pace the person likes. Some people just want to tap. They want to tap themselves like this, or the sides of their legs, or tap their toes. But these little devices are terrific. And so, yeah, that's what you watch. You watch me setting up her resources. Yeah. Is this the woman who was sexually abused by her grandfather, by the way?
I can't remember. I remember she brought in Mother Mary as one of her protective, compassionate healing sources. And
I don't know what's on YouTube.
Yeah. Anyway, it was very beautiful, very powerful. And you could just feel what the Quakers call a gathered moment, you know, where all this stuff comes together and something very important is happening. You guys, and it had a camera on you and a camera on her, so you could see both. And really extraordinary bit. And it's not very long, like 5 minutes. And it's just like, it's very impressive. So everybody go to YouTube and watch this. I think it'll really explain and get you to feel even more what we're learning here.
So the resources can be used to prepare people and support them before doing the trauma processing work, but we can use it also as a standalone technique. So that's kind of what I was referring to.
I was just going to chime in on a response to your question, John, about can one do some of these techniques by oneself? And I'm glad you got in before I did, Laurel, because you had a much better and fuller answer. But in my own experience, and I should say I did the EMDR training many years ago, so I have the neurotech equipment and occasionally, periodically, you know, try it on myself, but I've never found it as powerful as working with you. And that just makes, I can understand that in a lot of different ways, but that's my experience. But I have not tried some of these things you said, such as the installing protective or empowering figures. So obviously there are ways of using it that I haven't thought of that could be powerful, perhaps by myself. So Laurel, clearly a major part of both your own personal life and a context and inspiration for all your work with people is your own spiritual practice. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. So I was attracted to spiritual practice from the time I was really little and always questioning. You know, I rejected Christianity as a child because it didn't make sense to me. I was making my mother define what the terms meant in the Lord's Prayer, and she couldn't do it. And I was a very scientific child and was like, what do you mean? You know, what does this mean? And so when I was in high school, I was introduced to Tibetan Buddhism. And I felt like I'd come home. My teacher's name is Ken Grantham. He was a student of Tartang Tulku Rinpoche. This whole idea of look within your own mind, of direct experience, completely spoke to me. So I then was reading Alan Watts and, I'm trying to think of all the different people, Lama Govinda, and some of the explorations of consciousness and the people who were writing during that time. And it was Alexander David Neal. I did retreat with Tartang Tulku in the basement of the Nyingma Institute way back when. This is the 70s, right? And then I met Lama Yeshe in, was it 1973, 74, something like that. I was introduced to him by a former student of his who had become a nun. And I felt a deep, direct connection with her. And then I did a 3-week retreat when I was 20 in Lake Arrowhead with Lama Yeshe. So for those of you who don't know Lama Yeshe was the embodiment of pure, blissful love. you'd sit with Lama and he'd blow your circuits out with so much love, your body couldn't hold it. It would just be tears streaming down my face, my chest blown open, and just in that space of pure love and delight and joy and silliness. And he could get extremely serious and kind of pull back to this wrathful side. So he was all of that. And I was so blessed to do multiple retreats with him as he came to America, to do multiple initiations with him. And he died in 19, oh gosh, it's the 40th year of his passing. 40th year. And I was just a young mother. We cremated his body on the land in Boulder Creek. His students did. I sat in meditation as I breathed in the ashes of his body. It was profound and life-changing, all of that. And it was incredibly so much grief and so much being blown away. And then all these intense dreams came afterwards of purification and merging with him and all of that. And so I lost my beloved teacher, but along the way, I'd also been introduced to Vipassana. So 1975, I did a retreat with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. And I love the Vipassana work. I just took to it. And I love the simplicity of it. The Tibetan practices were so complex, and I'm not a good visualizer. So they'd have these elaborate things, and I'm like, I can't see anything. But I could feel the presence of Lama. I could feel the energies, but I couldn't visualize. So it was just too much, too complicated. I couldn't do the practices well, but give me a place to sit in silence. I was so happy. And so I began to do mostly Vipassana retreats. Every year I do at least two, 8-day retreats in Yucca Valley or Santa Rosa or somewhere mostly with Jack. Often with, Joseph would come around and I'd sit with Joseph also. This went on for years. And then what happened was I got extremely concentrated. I could sit for hours without moving. And everything just dropped away in this purity of concentration. And then I got up to do some yoga. I laid down and everything dissolved into consciousness itself. I call it an inside out experience. And I didn't know what happened. I just know that I went away and then I kind of came back, but everything had disappeared as I knew it. It felt like instead of things coming from me, I came out of something. And then when I would sleep at night, I would just drop into pure consciousness all night. It would just be consciousness all night long. And then I had a really hard time coming out of the retreat. And then Jack mentored me. And he was on the phone with me on a daily basis because I couldn't function. All he wanted to do was meditate and drop into those silent spaces. Then what happened was Vipassana didn't make sense anymore because there was no longer a path. So why are you practicing? You're practicing for something. The path had disappeared completely. All there is now. And so I felt a little bit lost and I didn't have anybody to really understand or explain what had happened because it's not supposed to happen on an 8-day retreat. It's only supposed to happen on 3-month retreats. I've never done a 3-month retreat.
Talk about limiting beliefs.
It was really a limiting belief. So I kind of didn't have direction And then I met Jean Klein. So Jean Klein, an Advaita master of non-dual spirituality, and I met him through a colleague, and he was very hard to understand. He had a very strong German accent, but this quality of silence and presence was so strong. Just in his presence, my mind would stop and I would drop into that silent nowness. And so long story short, I began to do retreats with Jean, and in one of them at Santa Sabina here in San Rafael, I had an interview with him, and he told me to let go of all concepts, everything. He's very direct about that. And that night, as I lay down, everything dissolved. All the constructs, a thought would come and it would just disappear. So all night long, there was the arising and the disappearing and the dissolution of everything until there was just that. And in the morning, everything had dissolved into and recognition of the isness. I call it a lucid isness that's ever present in everything. And they talk about this as like the light that is the light that illumines the film. So you see the film. Well, that was completely obvious to me. And it was completely obvious that everything is that. It was like, oh yeah, this has always been there. It's the most obvious thing in the world. Yet you can never touch it. It was like, it was all obvious, but everything had disappeared. So the mantras I had been doing, the practices, everything was gone. Everything was gone. And this was probably in the 80s, probably late 80s, early 90s. So, and then there was a bit of a struggle to kind of readjust to what is important in life, because everything else was seen as just a constructed belief. So I felt like I had woken up from the dream, but everybody else was dreaming still. And that's a kind of a lonely experience. And it wasn't joyful. It was hard. So then over time, it's like, what is important? And what is important is love, service, connections with people, the work that I was doing in terms of therapy. It kind of got distilled out. Family. I mean, there's not a lot. And there's no idea of projection into the future. It's like you make a plan. It's just a plan. You create an idea. It's all just seen as ideas. So there was that. And then Zhang was amazing and wonderful. And then he passed away. And then this new person showed up who was incredible. And this is Suzanne Siegel. I don't know if you remember or know Suzanne Siegel. Suzanne Siegel was a psychologist. She wrote a book called Collision with the Infinite. She had had an experience of a personal self completely dropping away at a bus stop in Paris.
Stay tuned to part three of this fascinating conversation with Dr. Laurel Parnell, where we look at the current cutting edge of Dr. Parnell's work, which involves multidimensional integrative healing, healing beyond the personal, and healing from the trauma of past lives. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I found it very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.